Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, another stabbing on the light rail by a suspect previously banned from local transit, raising questions once again about safety.
Why was he allowed back on the system?
Governor Stein says he will reverse cuts his administration made to Medicaid providers, quickly cautioning the money will run out and blaming the General Assembly.
All they had to do was their most basic and important job, pass a budget.
Republicans in that body say the move is politically motivated. A new CMS board is sworn in and is quickly told enrollment is down to its lowest level in 14 years. The lawsuit between racing teams and NASCAR is settled before the jury gets the case. And the Panthers will, they're number one, will play New Orleans this weekend, hoping for a win that could put them on the top of the NFC South. Actually, they're already there. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE education reporter James Farrell. He's here along with Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ashley Fahey is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. They'll duke it out amongst themselves. Well, welcome, everybody. Irina's law took effect on December the 1st in response to the August stabbing on the light rail. Just days after that law took effect, there was another stabbing, and it has revived concerns about safety on Charlotte public transit. Mary, what happened?
So police say that this stabbing was the result of an altercation between two men riding the blue line, happened near a stop in Noda. A man who officials say is an undocumented immigrant from Honduras who has previously been deported from the United States has been charged with first-degree murder, additional charges, as well as a federal charge similar to the suspect in the Irina Zarutska case.
Yeah, Oscar Zalarzano, I think is how you say his name. He's a Honduran. He faces a rare federal charge, which came down yesterday, that could send him to prison for the rest of his life.
Correct. Yes. And this is similar to a charge that the federal government filed against DeCarlos Brown, who is the suspect in the Irina Zarutska case. The man who was stabbed, police say, is continuing to recover. Reports indicate that he said something to the suspect and an altercation ensued. And an interesting kind of side note that came up this week, the person who was injured apparently also is facing a charge from an unrelated previous case from a few weeks ago.
Mr. Solorzano, who is the alleged attacker here, has been charged federally with a terrorist attack or other violence against a mass transportation system. It's rarely used. It's a relatively new, charge at their disposal, but they're using it anyway. This second stabbing in just over 3 months, like that of Irina Zarutska, almost immediately caught the attention of the White House. Donald Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, another stabbing by an illegal migrant in Charlotte. What's going on in Charlotte? Democrats are destroying it like everything else, piece by piece. End quote. Of course, the first stabbing was allegedly perpetrated by an American citizen on a Ukrainian immigrant. This time it was the other way around. But this Honduran is in the country illegally. He's already been banned from riding transit by CATS officials, which led City Council's Dimple Ashmera to ask some pertinent questions.
If the suspect was indeed previously banned, why was he allowed back on the system? And how are we enforcing those bans?
Eric, how are we?
Well, there was a lot of talk after the death of Irina Zarutska about enhanced security. And one of the things that's been talked about is this private security service that works with CATS and trying to ramp up fare enforcement because according to CATS, 60% of riders aren't paying fares. That's part of the problem. But the specific issue you're asking about, Mike, is really interesting because they have talked about more facial recognition technology and things that they can do to enforce bans, but those things have not happened yet. And it seems to me it would be pretty easy for someone who's been banned to walk back out onto a platform and get on a train or a bus. I mean, how are people going to know? You know, I mean, there's so many people on buses and trains. How are you going to know? And that I'm not saying that as an excuse, but it's just an obvious thing that that's a very tough thing to carry out. And clearly this is an example of that.
I want to come back to some of the measures they say they have taken to make things safer on transit. But first, Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino, who, if you recall, was here just before Thanksgiving with his band of merry men, the controversial incursion of his agency, the Border Patrol Agency, into Charlotte. He blamed North Carolina Governor Josh Stein for the stabbing, saying, quote, "The blood of innocence is on you. We've shown and told you for weeks now, yet you continue choosing illegal aliens over mob and Pa America." One problem with that, correct me if I'm wrong, Bovino was charged with removing the worst of the worst when he comes into a city like Charlotte. This suspect was deported twice. He's re-entered three times. His criminal history includes a prior robbery conviction in New Jersey. If he isn't the worst of the worst, I don't know who is. Was he on Bovino's radar when he was here, or were they just taking a scattershot approach, scooping up anyone they could?
Well, we know this much. We know that the Border Patrol, when they came, they made somewhere around 425 arrests, and very few of the people arrested, the names and charges, most of those have not been disclosed. And of course, many of us were reporting about the scattershot approach that you just mentioned, that you know, agents were riding through parts of town and just pretty much randomly targeting people. So as you can see, there is plenty of finger pointing to go around, and it is in full force.
So, Mary, somebody from The Observer rode the light rail and wrote about that experience this week in the paper. They said that no one checked to see if they had bought a ticket. They had. No one checked on anyone else that they could see, they said. Further, they said there wasn't much of a security presence. What did they report about that lack of security? What did they say?
Yeah, so that experience does to an extent echo what Katz has been saying since the Aruna Zarutska killing, that they are increasing staffing, they are increasing fare enforcement, but that it's unrealistic to have a security person on every train for every ride, to have every ticket checked on every ride, that Katz's system is not designed to have any sort of turnstile or gated entrance to the light rail system, where you have to show a ticket to sort of get into a gated off area to get on the train. So that's something that, you know, Katz has been facing questions about since this summer when the Aruna Zarutska stabbing happened, but something that they've continued to say will either require, you know, sort of a really major overhaul of how the system is designed and or a really, really significant increase in spending and staffing.
Eric.
Mike, I think some important context as we move forward with this is, remember that the tax that was passed in November to expand transit and roads, part of that was a new 27-member authority that has been created. They will meet for the first time next week. And a big thing that was discussed toward the tail end of that campaign in the wake of Aruna Zarutska's murder was the idea of forming a transit-specific police force. I would imagine that's going to be one of the first topics, and it will be quite interesting to see how many people they might want to serve on that, what it would cost, how it would work, because all the questions you're asking would feed right into that kind of force.
Ashley, following the stabbing, Mayor Lyles said that the city had, quote, invested heavily in increasing security on our transit system, and CMPD had been proactive in increasing its presence across the city. How much money have we invested in security on the transit system, and what do we have to show for it?
I don't actually know the answer to the amount, but I think there's a lot of questions being asked. This week, a lot of GOP members have been kind of going public and saying, you know, we need to be spending whatever money we can on transit security and safety. The city recently approved a $3.4 million kind of PR contract for trying to get people to use the transit system. And that kind of had some backlash because they're saying that money could be going instead to security. So I think there's just obviously a lot of attention on this right now, a lot of questions, especially as we're thinking about, to Eric's point, building out our transit system and what kind of investments are going to be made in the future for security, especially since this has happened twice in such a short period.
CAT says they have deployed additional off-duty CMPD officers and hired private security personnel and are utilizing new technology and safety reporting tools since the death of Irina Zarudzka. Could it be, Mary, that the reporter that rode the train for the Observer to detail all of this didn't see any security personnel because they're in plain clothes?
I can't say exactly what sort of uniform or clothing these security people are wearing. I know a big question that came up in the wake of the Irina Zarudzka killing, and specifically in the audit report from the state auditor's office of CAT system, that they sort of, a Republican state auditor, Dave Bolyak, sort of called Charlotte out for, is that while the overall number of security staffing has gone up in recent years, he was concerned that the vast majority of the security people are unarmed as opposed to armed security. So that has been a point of discussion, and I imagine will continue to be a point of discussion as this political rhetoric around safety and safety on the light rail specifically continues.
And what kind of new technology is being used? What are the safety reporting tools he was referencing? Does anybody know?
Something I've heard floated, and Eric mentioned it previously, is facial recognition technology as something that could be coming to help with things like fare enforcement and also enforcing.
That could be coming. They're claiming it's here. Whatever they're doing is happening now. So what's coming is coming. But what's happening now? Do we know?
Well, some of the things they did, remember, Mike, they started using a lot more off-duty officers. That was one thing. They had more hours for that group of people. They started with enhanced the bike patrols, the smaller vehicles that could get in and around the rail trail and some of those parts of light rail that you can't get to quickly with a car. So those were several of the things that they did, and those were announced, I think, in September, late August, early September. So those things are happening.
Okay. In an interview with WCNC-TV with Ben Thompson, Lyles said that safety needs to be a priority on transit, particularly on the trains, and particularly as these trains expand now to the northern towns.
If we're going to build new transit lines, and we are going to build one because we've committed that to the northern towns, we're going to have to build one that is already planned as a safe space to be.
Would that include retrofitting Blue Line stations too?
I don't know if we'll be able to do that, but we really are diving deeply into that conversation, and there will be some kind of assessment there.
So there is a conversation about putting turnstiles or some kind of gating system on the Red Line, and retrofitting the Blue Line would be incredibly difficult at this stage. But if they're looking to closing off these platforms so that you have to buy a ticket to get on the platform and to ride the train, which is what is in place on most other systems in the country, evidently, will that keep criminals away? Won't they just buy a ticket?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, part of the answer is, of course, nothing is 100% foolproof. So we have to be realistic about this. And at the same time, when you have two incidents like this in 3 months, clearly, there is a huge problem that has to be addressed.
Yeah. And they tried to address it at the General Assembly level with the passage of Irina's Law, which went into effect on December the 1st, 12 days ago. We'll talk about the impact or the effectiveness of that and other things when we come back. And we'll also talk about staving off cuts to Medicaid that the governor has decided to, a measure that the governor has decided to take. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We're here with James Farrell, education reporter for WFAE News. He'll be chiming in shortly. Ashley Fay is with us. She's the managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. There is a perception that has undoubtedly grown with this second stabbing on the light rail that transit is not safe. So the city hired a PR firm that Ashley alluded to a moment ago for $3.4 million to counter that impression, and that has created controversy of its own. Mecklenburg County Republican Party Chair Kyle Kirby speaking with WCNC-TV.
What on earth are we doing with the taxpayers' money if we're not protecting them first and foremost?
The controversy, of course, is over whether that $3.4 million should go to cleaning up our image or be better spent on law enforcement and prevention. Dimple Lajmira.
One is perception and one is reality. We got to ensure that we address the reality head on, and that will help with perception.
And when the General Assembly passed Arena's law, they said it would make communities safer by tightening bail and pretrial release rules and ensuring violent offenders and repeat offenders are not cycled back onto the streets. Solzano, the alleged perpetrator of this latest stabbing, was denied bail. Will he be in custody pending the outcome of his trial, or could he get out between now and the end of that trial? Do we know?
I don't think we know.
Okay. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden says we should not look to Arena's law to help with safety, adding that, in fact, it will merely put more strain on his jail staff. Why?
Well, the sheriff, he said it will cause overcrowding in local jails and that will create unsafe conditions. And I believe, and I apologize, I can't remember who reported this, but the jail population prior to this had already increased by 18% this year. So you can see why the sheriff would be worried about yet more crowding given those conditions.
Ashley.
The sheriff also made the point that with this law, additional resources and funding didn't come with it. So I think his point is, you know, you're passing this law, we're going to see an increase in population in the detention centers, but we don't have the additional resources to deal with that.
We've got 10 more prosecutors. The district attorney says he needs a couple of dozen more. We need more judges in court capacity. We need more jail capacity. And evidently, there's no funding in that law for any of that. And we need more mental health help because both, correct me if I'm wrong, but both of the alleged perpetrators of both of these instances have mental problems. Am I correct?
Definitely in the first case of DeCarlos Brown, the suspect who was arrested, his mother, among others, said that he had mental health problems. I don't know with the person who committed the crime a week ago.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Kenyan Dobie, who is the person who was initially hailed as a hero in all of this because he confronted the alleged stabber in the latest incident. That narrative has changed since recovering enough to leave the hospital. Evidently, CMPD arrested him for felony assault, inflicting serious bodily injury, and on misdemeanor charges. And he, too, was taken into custody without bond, pending a court appearance. So we are cracking down on bond, I guess. Yeah, Eric.
Oh, Mike, I was just going to mention real quickly when Ashley was talking about Sheriff McFadden and his unhappiness with the lack of additional funding. The Observer reported this week, and Mary, maybe it was you, I'm not sure, that the executive vice president from the North Carolina Sheriff's Association had said that he had not heard anyone complaining about Arena's law on the sheriff's side. So I think that's an interesting piece to this too.
Mary?
Yeah, I think, you know, Mecklenburg County Sheriff McFadden has sort of been in recent years in a more confrontational mode, for lack of a better phrase, than some other sheriffs with state leaders and Raleigh. His issues with Arena's Law are not new. He and many other leaders in local law enforcement and court systems spoke to the county commission a few weeks ago about the implementation of Arena's Law and made very similar comments. The phrase of the day at that meeting was unfunded mandate. The fact that the state is putting a lot of new requirements on the court system, on the county jail, and not really providing the county with any additional funding or resources beyond those additional staffers in the district attorney's office that Mike mentioned. So not really a new complaint from Sheriff McFadden, but certainly a conversation that's been renewed by this latest incident.
So moving to another topic that also has funding issues attached, the decision to expand Medicaid in North Carolina was predicated on the federal government paying 90% of the cost. But the lack of a state budget, and because of requirements placed on the state by Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill, Medicaid expansion in North Carolina is now at risk. That's why Governor Stein initially reduced reimbursements for doctors, hospitals, and other providers to make sure that what dollars we have stretch a little bit further. But that money was on schedule to quickly run out.
The minute that the state has to pay more than 10%, we're out. Okay? And so that is at risk. We don't know what that's going to look like.
That's Dr. Cotrain Penn, Division Director of Clinical and Contractual Services for Mecklenburg County. But now, Governor Stein says he's reversing the cuts he made to reimbursement. This isn't just about the money, however. Evidently, the governor's initial decision led to a wave of lawsuits from providers and others. Here's to Governor Stein.
In the first two cases, courts have ruled for the patients. Three more cases have already been filed, with even more waiting in the wings. DHHS can read the writing on the wall.
So if the governor initially took this action so that the money would last longer, Eric, that must mean it will now run out sooner. How soon?
The governor says by the spring. Obviously, that is well before the end of the fiscal year. And Mike, without getting into the weeds too much on this, this boils down to a fight over the state budget between the governor and the Republican leadership of the legislature. And as many listeners probably already know, North Carolina is the very last and only state that has yet to pass a budget this year. So that's where the standoff is.
Which is why the governor has laid this squarely on the shoulders of the General Assembly.
All they had to do was their most basic and important job, pass a budget. Understand that only one state's legislature in this entire country has not enacted a budget. That's North Carolina's.
So Stein has called their failure, quote, irresponsible and callous and infuriating because it was absolutely unnecessary. His words. Is there any indication that the General Assembly will take action on a funding stream for this, either as a discrete funding stream or because they're going to finally pass a budget? Any indication?
Well, we don't know how they're going to solve this, but there seems to be some cautious optimism that it will eventually get worked out. Even the governor himself said that he had spoken to Senate Leader Phil Berger and others, and he thinks that something will happen, but the delay, of course, is causing all kinds of problems. Remember, Mike, we have another 685,000 people who receive health care because of Medicaid expansion. That includes 83,000 that were added in Mecklenburg County. And part of the reason this is so problematic is that when those rates were cut and you get into those lawsuits, while all that's swirling around, clinics, doctors stop providing services, or they provide fewer services, and so people are not getting the care that they need. And also there is the worry that maybe some of those services just don't come back.
Meanwhile, Mecklenburg County leaders say uncertainty around state and federal funding could jeopardize behavioral health services if this is not ultimately resolved. And that has Mecklenburg County Commissioner Laura Meyer perplexed. She says healthcare remains too difficult to access, and she reminded people at this week's county commission meeting that nearly 350,000 people in Mecklenburg County alone receive Medicaid.
It's reprehensible how this is so complicated, and everything is a sin for what the state is doing what our insurance companies don't do, and it just is, it just really blows my mind.
So, staying on the topic of healthcare for a moment, Ashley, if prices weren't rising fast enough, if we weren't being nickeled and dimed to death enough, this year, Novant Health began charging for self-administered questionnaires. What are self-administered questionnaires?
Yeah, so there's a new thing at Novant, new-ish, I guess. It started last year, where they ask you a series of questions basically around depression, food insecurity, domestic violence, do you feel safe in your home, things of that nature. It's a fairly, like I said, fairly new thing. But what they
so
don't
it's a form. It's a form, and you check boxes, because I filled these out.
Exactly.
I've done this.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. So basically, it's a screening for, again, mental health, food security, domestic violence. But what they don't tell you is that there is a fee associated with filling out this questionnaire. Many of the insurance providers do kind of cover the fee, but not necessarily always. A few patients have been receiving bills in the mail, usually small amounts like $8, $15. But they're like, we didn't realize there was a fee associated with filling out this form, basically.
You know, I have to say that many times in advance of a doctor's appointment, I'll be asked to go online to the portal and fill out this questionnaire. And I get to the office and they hand me a clipboard and I'm filling the same damn thing out again. Can I charge them?
I don't know if I'm the person to answer that, but maybe.
Is Novant alone in this practice, or is this something, a start of a new trend?
Yeah, so this is kind of part of a new trend, Mike. We are just seeing, not just with these kinds of questionnaires, but in general, hospitals have started charging patients for services that at one point were more folded into just a regular office visit. So it's not limited to Novant. We don't really know for sure, you know, who in North Carolina exactly is doing this. A few folks have said that they are not doing it, but we didn't hear back from every healthcare system.
Are the fees covered by insurance, or is this out of pocket?
Many times they are, but some commercial insurers might see it as an extra assessment and then therefore charge it more of an ad hoc basis versus being kind of folded into a regular office visit. So I think that's where some of the confusion lies.
So when you think about the number of patients who access healthcare at Novant on a daily basis, each filling out one of these forms at $8 a piece, how much is the hospital making on this?
Well, that's the question. I mean, you got to think with the amount of patients you see, $8 per patient, let's just say, that adds up to probably millions in 1 year, I would think.
Wow. Okay, let's move on. James, it's swearing-in season, first on City Council. Now we have six new members this week of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board. Well, six of the nine seats were up for grabs. That resulted in four new members. Who are the four members?
Yeah, so the four new members are Charlita Hatch in District 1. She beat the incumbent, Melissa Easley. She's the Chief Data and Analytics Officer for the City of Charlotte. Talked a lot about her technology experience and data experience. In District 2, we have Shemaya Haynes, who's a longtime education advocate in West Charlotte. She's replacing Thelma Byers-Bailey, who stepped down after 13 years on the board. In District 5, we have Cynthia Stone, who upset Lisa Klein, who was at that time the only Republican on the board, and Cynthia Stone is a Democrat. And then in District 6, we have Anna London, who's replacing Summer Nunn, who stepped down after one term. And Anna London is the CEO of Charlotte Works, which is the region's workforce development board.
And Shemaya Haynes in District 2 spoke on Tuesday night about how her advocacy in the past at times made it so that she and her now colleagues didn't always see eye to eye, but she wants to work together going forward.
So I think it's important to say that if we keep the number one, which is the success of children in CMS, and hopefully parents will be satisfied with the work that we do, we will always be solid partners.
In what way was she at odds with these board people previously?
Well, Haynes has been very open about the fact that she was a very passionate advocate and sometimes came to board meetings. But she's also talked about kind of the good relationship she's had with board members. In my interview with her during the election season, she talked about approaching Thelma Byers-Bailey, the incumbent who she's replacing, and at times kind of, you know, coming into those conversations a little heated, but ultimately having a really good relationship with her. Byers-Bailey actually endorsed her in the election. And, you know, since then, I mean, all things point toward this being a really cohesive board. They all seem to be very much on the same page. I'll note that Stephanie Sneed, the board chair, posted a TikTok of them all dancing together beforehand. Shamaya Haynes has referred to them as the Fab Five plus one, the plus one being D. Rankin, who was the only one who didn't have an opponent in the election. So right now, the vibes are all pretty good between all of them. So I wouldn't see this as being an issue, at least in the immediate future. But I think Haynes was just referring to the fact that being an advocate sometimes means going to the board and asking tough questions or, you know, making certain allegations and things like that.
And one of the new board's first orders of business was to extend the contract of the current superintendent, Crystal Hill, and without discussion, approve a 7% raise of about $22,500. That takes her to about $340,770 in annual salary. When might she actually receive this additional money?
Yes, so the new amendment that they passed says that she will not get the money until the state passes a raise. So obviously that's tied to the budget discussions going on in Raleigh. There have been multiple proposals for different teacher raises. None of those have come to fruition. We've only seen the salary step increases for teachers. So she is not going to take any money until there is a teacher raise that's passed. And one thing I'll note, Mike, it actually was not the new board that passed this. They actually passed this before they swore in the new board. So it was the old board, and three of the prior board members were not at the meeting. So only, I think four, it's not the full board voted on it, though.
So this raise, whenever it comes, will be retroactive to December the 1st. Will that be the case if and when teacher raises finally get through the General Assembly?
That's a good question. I'm actually not sure about that off the top of my head.
They also extended her contract. It adds a year to her projected tenure. When will her contract expire now?
So it was originally set to expire in June 2028. Now it will expire in June 2029.
She may end up being one of the longest-serving superintendents in
recent
history.
Yes, that's right. I was actually looking at that right before last night. If she makes it to July, she'll have served three full calendar years. And the only other person I could find who did that, not counting like interim or acting status, was Peter Gorman in 2006 to 2011, served about 5 years. So she'd be the longest-serving superintendent since that time.
Wow, they've taken the wheels off the chair. She's there to stay. CMS enrollment is down, we find out. If you've lived here for any time, it wasn't that long ago that we were doing shows on a monthly basis about how we would ever keep up with a never-ending growth. Where would we put these students? How quickly and where could we build schools to accommodate the growing enrollment at CMS? And suddenly, it's all taken a different direction. Why?
That's a complicated issue. There's a lot of different factors involved here. Obviously, one of the ones we could point to that's most recent is the expansion of the private school voucher program. You know, one thing I'll note is that last year that funding had kind of got led to a wait list. It got held up a little bit. This is the first full school year where that funding is fully available from the beginning of the school year. So I wonder, and I'm kind of speculating a little bit, if that's reflected in this drop a little bit. Obviously, we've seen the expansion of charter schools. We've seen a lot of demographic forecasters talking about birth rates as well.
We have more to talk about with regard to declining enrollment at CMS and a couple of other school issues to go through with James Farrell from WFAE News. And the rest of our folks are here with us as well. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why Eric Spanberg is back for the 19th time this week. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary Ramsey is with us, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ashley Faye is with us again this week. She's with us from the Charlotte Ledger, where she is managing editor. And James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter. We were talking about CMS enrollment being down. Ashley, it's now at its lowest enrollment in 14 years. By how much has it fallen?
Yeah, so I mean, I think CMS was projecting that enrollment would remain flat. You know, it's been flat for the last few years. We did see kind of a COVID era decline, but it's been flat for the last couple of years. But instead of being flat, it actually declined by 1.7% year over year. And I wanted to note, Mike, normally these numbers and figures are released in October, but the figures really weren't accessible until this week, pretty much. You know, I know The Ledger, I'm sure other news outlets have been asking for this information since October. And this week, you know, CMS pointed to state numbers and said they're available now. So I just thought that was interesting.
What was the holdup?
Well, that's, I think, a question, right? Is it that, you know, they didn't necessarily want that out necessarily, that there's a decline year over year? It kind of goes against what was being projected in the spring, which was flat, like I said, enrollment. But Mike, I also want to situate this with the fact that, you know, our region is growing so fast. We are seeing a lot of millennials and people of childbearing age having kids, but at the same time, not just CMS, but other area public school systems are seeing declines year over year in enrollment.
Is this down system wide, or are there particular schools in particular areas where enrollment has declined more than in other areas? Does anybody know? Did they release those figures?
They did release enrollment for the whole system. What I can say is that we saw a statewide decrease in traditional public schools. It was about a 1.8% drop. From my math, I think that was the steepest decline I've seen in a single year. If you exclude 2020, where there was this big drop off because of COVID, that was the steepest decline since 2004. It was about 24,000 students less. We did see an increase when it came to the independent public schools, which includes like charter schools and lab schools. And then there is data that's available on a school-wide basis, but it would take some time to kind of tease through that and analyze where you're seeing trends and things like that.
So CMS has characterized this as a, quote, modest decrease in enrollment due in part to a decrease in birth rates. Is it that, or is it that we have more opportunity scholarships out there and more people than we thought were going to take advantage of them have done exactly that?
I do think birth rates is part of the conversation, Mike, but I don't think it's the full picture. We are just seeing Mecklenburg Charter School enrollment tripled in the past decade. You know, we're seeing an uptick in homeschooling. I don't have the data on that necessarily, but that is a factor. So I don't think it's strictly the birth rate thing, although that is part of it. High school classes especially are shrinking, and I think that's kind of reflecting a trend that we're going to see that will then trickle through to lower grades in coming years. But I just don't think that's the full picture.
Is this a blip, or is this the beginning of a trend?
At the state level, there was some demographic forecasts that were released in April that showed that public school, like the share of students going to public schools, would decline. The models were a little mixed as to whether that would mean the actual enrollment numbers would decline. Some models said yes, when you factor in the opportunity scholarships, for instance. Some showed maybe a slightly small increase if you don't factor that in. So back to your last question, I think the opportunity scholarships had to have played at least somewhat of a role in this, as did the increase in charter school enrollment. But certainly at the state level, they're looking at this being a trend of at least public school taking up a smaller share of students than they historically have.
And there's a financial aspect to this. I mean, maybe that's why they were slow walking this. I don't know whether that was happening or not, but funding for public education is tied to the number of students in seats in the classroom. So what financial challenges might this bring to our public schools?
Well, yeah, I mean, this will lead to a smaller allotment from the state for public schools. I think the bigger question, as we kind of just talked about, is a question of whether this is a longer term trend. If enrollment continues to drop, then you will, continue to see decreases in that allotment. And I think if you speak to public school advocates in particular, they will tell you that there's already not enough funding for public schools. So when you see this, this is concerning. They'll argue that the resources aren't going there to help make public schools the best they can to attract more students and things like that.
Meanwhile, parents of a student at Ardrick Hill High School have filed a lawsuit against the school board, claiming that the school board violated their daughter's right to free speech. What's this about?
Yeah, so this refers to the Spirit Rock out front of Ardrick Hill High School. If you're a parent at CMS, you've probably seen these Spirit Rocks where students will paint messages, school spirit messages, and things like that. Back in September, a student had painted a message that said, "Live like Kirk," referencing the murdered conservative activist Charlie Kirk. when this happened, the Ardrick Hill principal, Susan Nichols, put out a message to the school community saying that this was an act of vandalism, that law enforcement had been contacted in an investigation. They were participating in an investigation. Over the course of several weeks, this ended up kind of getting walked back by the school district. They later put out another statement that said this was not an act of vandalism. It did not violate the code of conduct. Law enforcement was not contacted to investigate. There was no criminal investigation. The crux of this lawsuit basically is alleging that this student's constitutional rights for free speech were violated, that she was kind of publicly humiliated and publicly accused of doing misconduct that was later revealed to not be the case. They're seeking damages and they want an injunction on sort of penalizing people for using the Spirit Rock. It's also worth noting the lawsuit claims that the student did call the school and ask for permission to paint the rock and says she was granted it and that, you know, any claims otherwise ended up not being true.
Yeah, they claim that they asked for permission, they were granted that permission, then the school censored her, had the rock painted over, saying that the painting of that rock was unauthorized. The school has since sent out an email clarifying the rock is, quote, not to be used for personal, political, or religious messages. Is this a new policy, or was this in place prior to this incident?
Well, the lawsuit alleges that there was sort of a scrambling behind the scenes to kind of piece together a more set policy on the Spirit Rock. The one thing I will also note, the Spirit Rock had a message on there that was a Bible verse. I'm sure that was one of the things that kind of raised concerns, given it's a public school, obviously. I think that that's where that other message, adding the religious part of it, was added in there as well.
Mary, we all remember Democrat Tricia Cotham running for her seat in the General Assembly, and when she won, she got back into her seat and changed parties. She became a Republican and gave the House, their at least temporarily, their veto-proof majority. And when she ran again after that, she squeaked by with a margin of 216 votes. Now, she is facing a challenger in the Republican primary for that seat, and her challenger changed parties to run in that primary. Kelly Van Horn is the challenger. Is she really a Republican, or did she just switch parties to go after Cotham?
Yes, so I spoke to Kelly Van Horn this week. She's a teacher and local education advocate. She acknowledged that she has voted in Democratic primaries previously, but also said she's been a, quote, independent voter, that she was sort of drawn to the Republican Party. She quoted to me the preamble to the party rules that were ratified at the most recent Republican National Convention. So she says this isn't a political stunt. She says that she wants to give voters a choice, that she would sort of be a relatively middle of the road independent state legislator. But yeah, certainly adds a wrinkle to this in a race where Cotham was already likely to face a pretty strong challenge from the Democratic Party. Former Matthewstown Commissioner Ken McCool has already filed as a Democrat in the district as well. Also, worth noting, Representative Cotham has not technically filed for re-election as of yesterday at 5 p.m.
She's being very clever about this. You quote Kelly Van Horn as saying that the Republican Party is the party of, quote, liberty, the party of equality and opportunity for all and favoritism for none. And she says that's what she stands for and decided to run as a Republican, to give people a choice. Is that a reference to gerrymandering? In other words, some of these districts are drawn in such a way that Democrats really don't have a choice. So if you are a Democrat and run as a Republican, you've kind of gamed the system. You've defeated the system.
Van Horn did bring up a gerrymandering as well, her word, not mine. Their district was redrawn after Cotham's party switch as part of redistricting. It did become more Republican friendly. It's not necessarily a deep red district, but there is a Republican advantage based on prior election data. And this is a strategy that we've seen in other parts of the Charlotte area. Kate Barr, who made a lot of headlines when she was running against Vicki Sawyer last year for her campaign slogan that she couldn't win because of gerrymandering, has switched parties and says she did so in name only to challenge Congressman Tim Moore. So not necessarily a new strategy, little bit of a different situation here. A candidate saying this is more of a change of heart than a political stunt. But again, it did bring up gerrymandering in our conversation as well.
I guess we have to wait to see. If she wins, we'll know whether she's a Democrat or a Republican, I suppose. You report that the town of Matthews has a new manager. The Matthews Board of Commissioners voted this week to promote Malia James to the role. Why was there an opening, and what did Malia James do previous to this?
Yes. So this opening was created by former Matthews manager Becky Hawk. Hawk left the town over the summer to become the city manager of Wilmington, North Carolina, moving into a little bit of a bigger market. And the town ultimately promoted from within. Ms. James was previously an assistant town manager under Hawk, so keeping it in the family over in Matthews.
And back to school for a moment, James. The Union County chapter of the NAACP says public schools there have failed to make good on an agreement to partner on several education initiatives. Be more specific.
Yeah, so there's a few things here. One thing, they had a citizens advisory committee that they had create some recommendations to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion across the district. The NAACP alleges that the district has not done enough to implement those recommendations district-wide. They've said that there were some tutoring initiatives, things like that. Both of them have said there was a memorandum of understanding where they had shared goals. And Archie Hansley, the president of the NAACP there, told me that they feel that Union County has not done enough to pull their weight in accomplishing those goals.
Here's what Archie Hansley had to say.
It's one thing to say you're in partnership with someone behind closed doors, but if you're not doing anything to establish that partnership, then to me, honestly, it's just an abusive one-sided relationship is what it is.
So what have Union County Schools said in response?
Yeah, UCPS has flatly refuted this. They've said that there are plenty of examples of the two of them working together. They've met very often. They pointed to things like a local youth council that's still available in some schools that they worked on together. You know, for his part, Hansley told me that they just feel that that partnership has not been robust enough. It was not what they expected based off of, again, that memorandum of understanding. So, yeah, but I mean, this is another conflict with UCPS. We've seen a few in the last couple months. They recently kind of gone to head-to-head with some teachers who wanted to see a bigger raise from the county. There's been some finger pointing between the school board and the county on that issue. So it's just kind of interesting to see another kind of public feud going on just months after the school district was announced as the highest performing district in the state.
We all know that students in school are given letter grades, and so are the schools in North Carolina. That's something that has received critical pushback from education leaders for a while, these grades given to schools. How does that grading system work?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, when you see that letter grade assigned to a school, 80% of that grade is based off of how well students did on state tests the year before, and then 20% of the grade is based off of how much they improved by, or what schools often refer to as growth. But yeah, Mike, like you said, there's been a pushback to this of people saying that it sort of overemphasizes the performance and test results from what is effectively just 1 week out of the school year.
And state school board member Alan Duncan says the existing system offers a narrow view of school performance.
We have seen fairly stable rates of new cases the last 4 or 5 years. And in this year, 2025 calendar year, we're actually on track to have fewer cases than we did last year, new cases. And so I think that's a reflection of both the progress that's been made through those initiatives I talked about earlier, and then the work that we're doing to make sure that individuals living with HIV are virally suppressed.
Well, that's the wrong cut. Isn't that special? Anyway, so now when will these changes? They're looking at making changes to the system. So when might they do that? When might they take effect?
Yeah, so it's about a 2-year process that they're hoping to have this in place by the start of the 2028 school year, if I'm remembering correctly. But of course, that's going to depend on a lot of things. They're going to have to get some legislative changes passed, which means that the General Assembly is going to have to be on board with whatever it is that they end up proposing.
Okay, Eric, you're on the hot seat now because a trial's been going on for 9 days involving NASCAR team owners, including Michael Jordan, in a suit over NASCAR. And it included NASCAR CEO Jim France. The owners claimed that NASCAR's actions violated antitrust laws. It seems all very arcane and complicated, but it all ended before the jury got a chance to decide. What's it all ended about, Alfie?
Yeah. It ended yesterday. I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. The fight, shockingly, was about money. And the money part is whether the team owners have a guarantee to be in every race, which, of course, you know, like the Hornets and the Panthers, if they didn't know they were going to be in a game every week, that would affect your ticket sales, your sponsorships, all those business items. And so that, in essence, was what the fight was about. They reached a settlement. They have not disclosing the details, and they don't plan to. So that tells me and you and everyone else that both sides gave a little bit.
Yeah, and so and both sides won. Probably, particularly Michael Jordan's side seems to have won. And it also, I guess, I read this morning that NASCAR kind of won because had this gone to the jury, this might have opened a can of worms about NASCAR being a monopoly.
Yeah, well, I think there's no doubt that NASCAR is a monopoly. It was just how bad were the damages going to be? And so they finally reached a settlement. And that's what we see in cases like this a lot of the time. So 9 days, the Michael Jordan court case is at an end. Sorry if you missed it.
Something has happened to the Carolina Panthers. They're winning. And they're on a playoff track. This Sunday, they hope to find themselves at the top. Well, they are at the top of the NFC South because yes. Tampa lost to Atlanta last night by 1 point. They're playing against the New Orleans Saints. Now, the Saints aren't great this year, but the game is away, and Bryce Young has not had a ton of success against New Orleans. The Panthers lost against them at Bank of America Stadium earlier this season, 17-7. What's the line on that game this Sunday?
Oh, that's a good question, Mike. I don't know the line, but the Panthers are favored. I think they've only been favored maybe twice this season, something like that. But I can tell from your careful viewing of the Atlanta-Tampa Bay game last night that you have a good feel for the Panthers going into New Orleans and getting a win and continuing on with a playoff berth with a couple more wins the rest of the way.
What you said. That's Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, here today with Ashley Fahey, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and James Farrell with us. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.